From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
What you're reading is wild speculation, which is it's kind of a, you know, happens quite frequently here in the nation's capital.
President Bush denies a report by investigative journalist Seymour Hersh that the U.S. is planning for a possible major air attack against Iran. We'll speak with Seymour Hersh. Then the French government caves to mass protest and overturns a law that would make it easier to fire young workers. And Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi refuses to concede defeat. We'll go to Italy and France. Then investigative journalist Greg Palast returns from Venezuela.
Next month, Chavez hosts the meeting of OPEC and will ask them to formally recognize that Venezuela now has more oil than the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Iranian government has announced it's enriched a small quantity of uranium for the first time. In a ceremony Tuesday, the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, said, quote, Iran has joined the nuclear countries of the world. The UN Security Council has demanded Iran cease uranium enrichment altogether. Several analysts said Iran is far away from approaching large-scale nuclear capability. An official at the International Atomic Energy Agency told the Los Angeles Times, quote, If they've enriched for 5 minutes, it's one thing. If you have major enrichment, it's another. We'll have more on Iran after headlines. The Washington Post is reporting the Bush administration claimed to have found mobile weapons labs in Iraq after the invasion. Despite the explicit conclusions of a Pentagon-sponsored mission, the claim was untrue. On May 29, 2003, President Bush cited the discovery of the trailers in an attempt to justify his decision to go to war nearly 2 months earlier. Bush said, quote, We've found the weapons of mass destruction. But just 2 days before, a Pentagon team sent to Iraq had concluded the trailers were, in fact, quote, the biggest sand toilets in the world. One team member said, quote, Within the first 4 hours, it was clear to everyone that these were not biological labs. The Bush administration failed to make the findings public and continued with its faulty claim for more than a year. In Pakistan, a twin suicide bombing at a Sunni Muslim prayer ceremony in Karachi killed at least 57 people and injured dozens more. The attack was one of the deadliest bombings in Pakistan's history. The bombing set off riots among youths who burned a gas station, buses, and several cars. In Italy, billionaire tycoon-turned-president Silvio Berlusconi is refusing to concede defeat in the national elections. Official results show an opposition coalition has won control of both the House and Senate. Berlusconi says there were voting irregularities and is demanding a recount. His opponent, Romano Prodi, spoke after the results were announced.
It was a hard job, a difficult battle till the last moment. But we got it, both in the chamber and in the Senate. Now we have a majority also in the Senate, and so there is no problem to have a strong government for my country.
With Berlusconi's loss, President Bush will lose a key European ally. Romano Prodi has pledged to withdraw Italian troops from Iraq and has criticized Berlusconi's treatment of terror suspects. In Spain, 29 people were indicted Tuesday in connection with the 2004 Madrid train bombings. 191 people were killed and 1,800 injured when bombs exploded aboard four rush-hour commuter trains. Six of the 29 accused were charged with counts of murder. The remaining 23 were charged with collaborating to carry out the attack. In Gaza, thousands of Palestinians marched Tuesday at the funeral of a young Palestinian girl killed by an Israeli rocket shell. 4-year-old Hadil died when an Israeli forces was fired on her house in the northern Gaza Strip Monday. 12 people, including 5 children, were injured in the attack. Hamas spokesperson Mushir al-Masri had this response.
What the Israeli occupation is carrying out, the shelling of homes which are safe every minute, is an unprecedented Israeli escalation with the aim to bring the Palestinian people to their knees and to bring about unjust political concessions from our government.
Meanwhile, the U.S., Canada, and the European Union have now all cut off financial aid to the Hamas-led Palestinian Authority. The aid freeze will continue until Hamas renounces violence and recognizes Israel, they say. On Tuesday, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas renewed his calls for direct negotiations with the Israeli government. Israel says it'll speak to Abbas but will not engage in final status peace talks. Nepal is in the seventh day of a renewed phase of protests against the rule of King Gyanendra. The anti-government unrest marks the most sustained show of opposition since the king seized power in a coup last year. The government has responded with curfews, mass arrests, and armed force. Police assaults on protesters were reported in at least three areas around the country Tuesday. Overall, three demonstrators have been killed, hundreds injured in the last week. According to the Federation of Nepalese Journalists, more than 110 Nepalese journalists have been arrested alone. Here in the United States, a former White House aide denied Tuesday his office was involved in a phone jamming scheme intended to block New Hampshire Democrats from carrying out an Election Day Get Out the Vote campaign. On November 5, 2002, the telephone lines at the New Hampshire Democrats' voting headquarters received scores of hang-up calls. Ken Melman, who now chairs the Republican National Committee, admitted New Hampshire Republicans spoke to the White House around the time of the election, but he said the phone jamming was not discussed. Phone records show that Bush campaign official James Tobin made two dozen calls to the White House during the three-day period in question. Tobin served as the New England chair of President Bush's reelection campaign at the time. He and two others have already been convicted in the case. No White House or national Republican officials have been charged. In other news, the Boston Globe is reporting thousands of low-income Americans are at risk with the pending activation of a federal law that would require them to show proof of U.S. citizenship in order to receive health care. The requirement was attached to the Deficit Reduction Act, which President Bush signed into law this year. Health care advocates said the requirements could adversely affect undocumented immigrants and Medicaid recipients who will be unable to provide the necessary documentation. Bill Walczak, chief executive officer of the Codman Square Health Center in Massachusetts, said, quote, "We didn't create the health care centers to become citizenship enforcement centers." The National Security Archive has revealed the government agency responsible for state archives colluded with the CIA and other intelligence agencies to remove thousands of previously declassified historical documents that were previously available to the public. In a secret agreement, the National Archives and Records Administration agreed to remove the archival records and reclassify them in order to avoid scrutiny from researchers. The reclassification scheme was disclosed earlier this year, but details of how it came about were largely unknown. And in Washington, Vice President Dick Cheney was greeted with loud boos Tuesday when he threw out the ceremonial pitch at the opener for Major League Baseball's Washington Nationals. This wasn't the first time Cheney's gotten a hostile reception at a baseball game. In June 2004, Cheney was booed at a Yankees game here in New York. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we begin our show today with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Seymour Hersh, in the latest issue of The New Yorker magazine, Seymour Hersh reports the Bush administration has increased clandestine activities inside Iran and intensified planning for a possible major air attack. Sources told Hersh that Air Force planning groups are drawing up lists of targets and teams of American combat troops have been ordered into Iran undercover to collect targeting data and to establish contact with anti-government ethnic minority groups. One of the military's initial option plans calls for the use of a bunker buster tactical nuclear weapon against suspected underground nuclear sites. On Monday, President Bush dismissed Hersh's article.
What you're reading is wild speculation, which is happens quite frequently here in the nation's capital.
Meanwhile, reporters questioned Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld Tuesday about Hersh's report.
In recent weeks or months, have you asked the Joint Staff and Central Command, possibly through General Pace, to update, refine, modify the contingencies for possible military options against Iran?
We have, I don't know how many, various contingency plans in this department. And the last thing I'm going to do is to start telling you or anyone else in the press or the world, at what point we refresh a plan or don't refresh a plan, and why. It just isn't useful.
Are you satisfied with the state of planning for Iran options
right now? I am never satisfied.
That was Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld Tuesday. Meanwhile, Iran's moving forward on its nuclear program. On Tuesday, the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, announced the country had succeeded for the first time in enriching uranium on a small scale. The Iranian president insists the country's nuclear program is for peaceful means and not to build nuclear weapons. We're joined right now in Washington by investigative journalist Seymour Hersh. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Well, talk about what you have found and written about in your piece, The Iran Plans.
Well, very simply, as you said in the introduction, this is not wild speculation. It's simply a fact that the planning has gone beyond the contingency stage and has gone into what they call the operational stage, sort of an increment higher, and it's very serious planning, of course. And it's all being directed at the wish of the President of the United States. And, I can understand why they don't want to talk about it, but that's just the reality.
You say that it's a pretty widespread, or that there's a growing conviction among members of the U.S. military and the international community, that President Bush's ultimate goal is regime change in Iran.
There's no question that there's a lot of skepticism, particularly among our former the allies we now have, the European allies who have been with us, and the United States joined late after the negotiations began. But England, France, and Germany have been talking to the Iranians for years, 3 years now, about doing something about to get them, cut it, keep them away from the nuclear edge, and we our allies there are frankly skeptical about what this president really wants to do. They don't think necessarily all of this, it's not that the president isn't concerned about any enrichment. He's set that as a red line. He's publicly said many times that when Iran begins to enrich, that's a line we won't let him do. It's that they really think that beyond the whole issue is really predicated on a belief that we've got to get rid of these ruling clerics and replace it with Bush's idea that he thinks he's still pushing very hard, which is of a democratic Middle East.
Cy Hersh, you write in your piece about a military official who says that the military planning is premised on the belief that a sustained bombing campaign in Iran will humiliate the religious leadership. Can you talk more about what this defense official said?
Well, he's a former defense official who still does a lot of highly classified stuff, so he has access, and he was given a briefing or a look at what they're planning. And it's hard to know. This is a White House that's very dominated. This kind of planning is very dominated by the vice president's office. And in that office, you have a number of people who have long been associated with what we call the neoconservative point of view, the American Enterprise Institute point of view, which is a very hard line towards the Middle East. They've been the great pushers on this idea of democracy in that area. And it's those people who I think are pushing most effectively the president and the vice president to believe that you can, if you bomb, and if you sustain the bombing, you will humiliate the clerics, the mullahs who run the country. And this, after all, as we know, the Middle East, basically oversimplifying it, but it's this culture that dominated by shame. We operate out of guilt here in the West. And shaming them will make them vulnerable to the masses. And there's no question, by the way, the masses in Iran, most of them, it's fair to say that a great large percent of them are very secular. They're all good Muslims, but they're secular. They're not interested in religious leadership. So there is a tension. And that was the thought. Bomb them, and there'll be an overthrow, and you'll have a democratic regime that, can dance happily with the democratic regime the president thinks is going to emerge out of Iraq.
And you quote further this defense official who talked about the belief that the Bush administration has of humiliating the religious leadership as saying, I was shocked when I heard it and asked myself, what are they smoking?
That's what he said.
Can you explain what the Science Defense Board is, the Defense Science Board, and what it has to do with this?
Actually, a lot. And it's interesting because this hasn't been picked up, and it's just hanging there, sort of like ripe fruit, for, it seems, for the press if they wanted to. It's an advisory board that's traditionally a defense science board, obviously. It's just an advisory board of scientists who advise the Secretary of Defense on issues, and they do some very serious work. They just did a paper recently on the declining rate of high-tech scientists inside that are capable of doing a missile, the kind of work we need for to continue our leadership in outer space stuff, et cetera, with a military point of view. And their whole purpose, of course, is a military point of view. Many of them also work for large defense contractors. There's a lot of inherent problems in that, too. But nonetheless, in this case, the board is headed by a guy named Dr. Bill Schneider, William Schneider, former very conservative guy, very outspoken. Schneider is among a small group of very influential members of the Bush government who in 2001 produced a paper, just as Bush was coming into office for the first term, they produced a paper advocating or saying, let's not rule out the use of nuclear weapons. There is a need for tactical nuclear weapons, and they should be in the arsenal and accepted as a rational part of the arsenal, particularly when you're going after hard targets like the underground nuclear facilities in North Korea and Iran, if you were to target them. And the people that signed that report include Schneider, as I say, but also Stephen Hadley, who's now the National Security Advisor, Stephen Cambone, who's the head of intelligence for the Pentagon and one of Rumsfeld's closest advisors, and also also Robert Joseph, who's the Undersecretary of State for Nonproliferation Affairs, the man who replaced John Bolton in that job, and who's been very much a hawk and very tough on Iran in public, and even tougher in private. And so you have these very influential people advocating that TAC nukes have some sense and some bearing in the policy. And I've been told that in the last few months, as the debate's been sort of ongoing inside the highest levels of the military, and the debate is simply between those senior generals and admirals who think using and even planning or talking about using a nuclear weapon in Iran is wacko, and the White House, because the White House wants it kept in the plan. There's a lot of tension there, but in any case, the Science Board has been sending papers in saying, hey, you know, we can tool this weapon up and down. The B-61, apparently the yield can be adjusted. You can get more bang for the buck, a larger yield with less radioactive fallout. And so these kind of papers go on. What's interesting, Amy, is in all of the conversations we've had about bombing and not bombing and whether to use weapons, what weapon, or how much bombing, as not surprisingly, I don't think there's been any serious discussion of possible civilian casualties. That never seems to be discussed in any of these papers, but that's the way it is.
In your response to the Iranian president saying Iran has joined the nuclear countries of the world?
Well, he's another sort of wacko, too. The Iranian president is very mouthy, and he says a lot of things. I think the consensus among our allies who have embassies in Tehran and have had much more contact and know much more about that society than we do, America is we're pretty much opaque on Iran. We haven't been there diplomatically, 25, 26 years since the Shah's days. Most people think that the Ayatollah Khamenei, who's the supreme leader, probably controls the nuclear option, although certainly the Revolutionary Guards, of which the Iranian president is a major player, have something to say. Look, they didn't join the nuclear club yesterday. They've done a partial enrichment of some uranium to a low level, a level that could possibly be used to run a peaceful reactor. They've done this before in a pilot program. It's a feat that's technically capable. Many governments have done it, not just the eight nuclear powers. And so what he's doing by embellishing this is my guess, my sort of heuristic guess because I don't know, but what I think he's doing, he's basically playing chicken, like in the old James Dean movie, the two cars going at each other at high speed. He's playing chicken with the President of the United States. So that's what we're into. We've got the President of the United States who's been making Bush, as you know, and Ray and Cheney have been making an awful lot of bellicose statements in the last couple of months, saying that they'll rule out no option, which obviously is a nuclear suggestion. Also making declarations about red lines and where Iran can and cannot go. So the bellicosity of the United States is now being matched by the bellicosity of the Iranian president. I mean, great way to run a world.
We're talking to investigative journalist Seymour Hersh. His piece in The New Yorker magazine is called The Iran Plans: Would President Bush Go to War to Stop Tehran from Getting the Bomb? Can you talk about the list of targets?
Well, you know, I don't really know the list, and I don't want to know the list. It's not my, just as when I write about troops, I'm vague about what I know and what I'm writing, because nobody wants to put anybody in a position of jeopardizing any of our forces on the ground. And you should know that I go to great lengths. Before I publish a story, I have people that I can drop a draft of an article in a mailbox in, you know, rural Washington, somewhere in the suburbs, where people, serious people, live, and they'll review it for me to make sure. I don't do it with this government, but I do it with serious people on the inside, and take their advice on what to publish and not publish. But the targeting, look, there's, first of all, we don't know much about Iran. The intelligence is skimpy. We really don't know what they're doing. We know that one major facility is an underground I've got called Natanz. It's an underground, I don't know what you call it, research plant, 75 feet below the ground, in very heavy rock. This is why there's some talk of using a nuclear weapon. The only way of guaranteeing its destruction is with attack nuke. It's so deep underground. Well, there's also about 16 to 20 sites that have been declared. And all of this is not being done in a vacuum. The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, has been monitoring Iran's declared sites. For example, when Iran enriched uranium, as it was announced yesterday, that was done under IAEA supervision. And so Iran has been a member of the, and I should also add, it's not illegal, because under the NPT, they're entitled to do enrichments as long as for peaceful purposes, and that's the claim the Iranians make. Nobody has any illusions. Iran undoubtedly would like to get in a position where they could have the capability and the know-how and the materials, the enriched materials, to make a fabricated nuclear weapon, sort of an on-off switch. They'd like to be able to toggle it. But the best guess, even the Israelis, who are, of course, they view Iran as an existential threat, Israel does, the Israelis are, they can't tell you that Iran's anywhere from 2 to 3 years at the best, by their estimate, from actually being in a position to do it. The American intelligence estimate, which was published last summer by the Washington Post, what they call the NIE, the National Intelligence Estimate, an official document, said something like 8 to 10 years away. So what's the rush is what I'm hearing from the military people and the diplomats involved. What are we setting red lines for about small pilot production? And so there is time, but if you're going to do it, if you're going to hit Iran and you're going to bomb and you give it to the planners, you're going to get this. You're going to get targeting for the known facilities, targeting facilities we suspect, and then you're going to get countermeasures. You're going to get the Air Force. Nobody in the American government wants to see American boys, pilots, shot down and paraded through the streets of Tehran, as we did in Vietnam, if you remember. That happened in Hanoi. So you're going to do, if you're going to do systematic bombing or sustained bombing, you're going to take out the airfields. Iran has an old, antiquated air force based, many of the planes were given to the Shah by us back in the 70s. But they still fly, and they're still armed with missiles. They have a very, Iran, as many in your audience knows, kicks out about 4 million barrels of oil a day, and has, the prices are very high, going higher, huge financial reserves. Has been buying a lot of sophisticated radar, anti-missile radars, and other sort of anti-aircraft radars from the Chinese, and I think even from Russia. We have to take that out. We don't want radars targeting our plane. We have to take out all of the defense measures so we can bomb with impunity. So how many targets are you looking for? I quoted one paper done by a retired Air Force colonel, a planner named Sam Gardner, who's been doing a lot of war games, who's a very prudent, by everybody's account, prudent, careful man. And Colonel Gardner, and in a paper he delivered in Europe the other week, said 400 aim points. And some of the aim points may have more than one or two bombs dropped on them. So it's a huge enterprise.
We're talking to investigative reporter Seymour Hersh, and we're going to come back to him in a minute to talk more about his piece, The Iran Plans, what the president of the United States plans are for Iran. Stay with us. Say you're sorry. It's no other choice. God bless the people now. Bomb the World, Michael Franti here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest in Washington, D.C. is Seymour Hersh, investigative reporter with The New Yorker magazine. His latest article is called The Iran Plans, How Far Will the White House Go? In the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq, Tony Blair, the British Prime Minister, and President Bush were at Camp David. They held a news conference, and they said that the UN International Atomic Energy Agency had a report that said that Iraq was 6 months away from building nuclear weapons. And President Bush said, "I don't know how much more evidence we need." Well, it turned out any evidence would have helped, that the IAEA did not have such a report. Do you see parallels here with Iran?
How can you not? You know, what's interesting about that IAEA issue is that they were, as you know, they had inspectors there until 68, late 68. And in late 67, the IAEA published an extensive analysis of the Iranian nuclear complex and basically said nothing, nada there. I mean, categorical. That's why I was very—because it's a long—I happened to be working, doing a lot of reporting on what was going on in the U.N. then. And with the UNSCOM, it was called the United States— the UN inspection process. So I'd read that report. So anybody reading that report would have known there was nothing there. You do have a lot of parallels because right now it's been taken away from the IAEA to, I must say, to the disappointment and probably anger, definitely anger of the leadership there, because at least the IAEA has inspectors and some legal right to be inside Iran right now, and they've taken it to the UN where there's a, you know, are there going to be sanctions or not? I mean, I don't know what kind of economic sanctions you can put on a country that puts out 4 million barrels of oil a day and is turning, you know, they're swimming in U.S. dollars. And, of course, everybody knows inside, all of the people involved know that Russia and China will never go along. And, you know, it's almost inconceivable they will go along with sanctions. China is one of the recipients of oil. Russia does a lot of business there. So you're basically, you've put yourself in a situation where you've got a dead end. And you know it's going to be a dead end. Or at least you can anticipate it could change, something could happen. But at this point, it's a dead end. And so the parallel is obviously obvious. Everybody I talk to, the hawks I talk to, the neoconservatives, the people who are very tough, absolutely say there's no way the UN's going to work. And we're just going to have to assume it doesn't in any way. Iran, by going along with the UN, is simply what they're really doing is rushing their nuclear program. And so the skepticism, there's no belief, faith here, ultimately, in this White House, in the extent of the talk. So you've got a parallel situation. The president can then say, we've explored all options, we've done it. I can add, if you want to get even more scared, some of our closest allies in this process, we deal with the Germans, the French, and the Brits. They're secretly very worried, not only about what Bush wants to do, but they're also worried that, for example, the British Foreign Officer, Jack Straw, is vehemently against any military action, of course, also nuclear action, and so is the Foreign Office, as I said, but nobody knows what will happen if Bush calls Blair. Blair's the wild card in this. He and Bush both have this sense of, this messianic sense, I believe, about what they've done and what's needed to be done in the Middle East. I think Bush is his every bit as committed into this this world of rapture as is the president.
Cy Hirsch, you write about a meeting in Vienna between Mohamed El-Baradei, the Pulitzer Prize, Nobel Peace Prize winner, and head of the IAEA, and Robert Joseph, the Undersecretary of State for Arms Control, and the relationship between El-Baradei and the United States.
Well, Joseph just basically was, you know, essentially just, it was pretty... I heard a lot about it because it was pretty blustery, and he just went in and basically told off the head of the Nobel Prize winner and said, you know, you will stop. The European and American complaint against El-Baradei is this. That's, they say, my God, he's treating this issue as if both sides have some justification, that Iran's aspirations equal the American and Europeans' desire not for them to go nuclear. He's treating them both as parodies, and they're not. We're right and they're wrong, and he doesn't reflect that. So they think he's unfair. They think he's being too balanced, too nuanced, and that was the message that Joseph gave, basically, with a significant loss of temper, or let's put it, intemperate behavior, basically saying you will decease from saying anything that interferes with us. We view this as our gravest national security threat. I can also tell you Joseph has said the same thing in Turkey. To the Turkish officials, he went there, and they also reported a very boisterous meeting. And the American ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency is a guy named Greg Schulte, who was, until last summer, August of 2005, was in charge of the Situation Room in the White House, and who, from 1992, worked for, he's a career diplomat, but he worked a career bureaucrat. He's not in the diplomatic service. He worked for Dick Cheney when he was Secretary of Defense, now the Vice President, and did nuclear stuff for him. So he's very connected to the Vice President. He's also quite direct and not very diplomatic in what he believes. And it's, you know, it's they're bad guys, we're good guys, that sort of approach. There's no instinct. What's amazing, Amy, about this is this, and what always surprises me about my country, is here we have a president that doesn't talk to people he disagrees with. And anybody who's been around little boys, big boys, knows that when they get out of control, you grab them. If you're a nursery school teacher, you grab the little four-year-olds by the scruff of the neck and you pull them together and you say, you two guys shake hands and make up and go play in the sandbox. Bush doesn't talk to people he's mad at. He doesn't talk to the North Koreans. He didn't talk to the insurgency. When the history is done, there were incredible efforts by the insurgency leaders in the summer of 2003. I'm talking about the Iraqi insurgency, the former Sunni generals and Sunni and Baathist leaders who were happy to see Saddam go but did not want America there. They wanted to talk to us. Bush wouldn't, whether it got to Bush, I don't know, it got into four stars. Nobody wanted to talk to them. He doesn't talk to the president of Syria. In fact, specifically rejects overtures from Assad to us. And he doesn't talk to the Iranians. There's been no bilateral communication at all. Iran has come hat in hand to us. A former National Security Council advisor who worked in the White House, Flint Leverett, ex-CIA analyst who's now working at Brookings, wrote a piece a month or so ago, maybe 6 weeks ago, in the New York Times describing specific offers by the Iranians to come and let's deal on all issues. I'm even told they were willing to talk about recognizing Israel. And the White House doesn't talk, and it's not that he doesn't talk. It's that nobody pressures him to talk. There's no pressure from the media, no pressure from Congress. Here's a president who won't talk to people he's walking us into a confrontation with.
Seymour Hirsch, we will leave it there. I want to thank you very much for being with us. But let me ask you one last thing, and that is where we started with President Bush's comments about your report, saying what you're reading is wild speculation, which is kind of, you know, happens quite frequently in the nation's capital, your response.
Well, he gave a speech at Johns Hopkins on Monday. That's one of the more remarkable speeches, not only because of his manner, which was a funny affectation. He was hopping around almost jocular. Forget what he said about me. It's what he said about Iraq that was very troubling to me. He once again said there's great progress. This is a wonderful thing we're doing. I'm proud that we're doing it. We're bringing democracy. I have it in front of me because I always carry it around. He said... he compared this is an ideological struggle we're having with Iran that equates the best part of the Cold War when we defeated the Russians. He's once again comparing this to the Cold War. He's once again saying that things are wonderful, that it's a noble enterprise. Does anybody there read the newspapers is what I wonder.
Seymour Hersh, thanks very much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Investigative reporter for The New Yorker magazine. The piece in the latest edition is called The Iran Plans. How far will the White House go? This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. As we move on to our next segment, in France, mass student protests and labor strikes have forced the French government to abandon a controversial new law that would have made it easier for companies to fire young workers. Over the past 2 months, millions of students and union activists filled the streets of France's major cities in some of the largest protests since the 1968 student uprising. Students forced the closure of more than half the nation's universities, including the Sorbonne, which the police raided following a student sit-in. The protests began February 7th when students stormed the Rennes University and shut down the school. Student leaders are hailing this as a historic victory, but they're also pressing for greater reforms. On Tuesday, thousands continued to protest in many cities, including Paris, Toulouse, and Nantes. At least five schools remain closed because of student blockades. Politically, analysts say Prime Minister Dominique de Villepin has suffered most by the protests, his approval ratings now below 30%. He spoke on Tuesday.
Les discussions conduites depuis une semaine par les présidents des groupes parlementaires.
The discussions held last week by the presidents of the parliamentary groups, Bernard Accoyer and Joselin de Rohan, with all the social partners, and with high school and university students, have led me to the conclusion that the necessary conditions of confidence and calm are not there, either among young people or companies, to allow the application of the first job contract.
Ni du côté des entreprises pour permettre l'application du contrat première embauche.
That was French Prime Minister Dominique de Villepin. We go now to Gilbert Achecard, who's professor at University of Paris. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. The significance of the government caving in to the massive protests around France.
Yes, well, that's absolutely enormous. The significance is not only French, actually. It's European, and one could even say global in a sense. But in a very direct sense, it's European, because that's part of a European-wide fight against neoliberal reforms. And the French have, the French mass movement have inflicted a second defeat to this neoliberal plan at the European level, the first being last year in May, on the 29th of May, when you had a majority rejecting the EU constitutional treaty, the European Union constitutional treaty, which was based on a neoliberal conception of European economy.
Gilbert, I know you're in Italy now, and I want to talk about the two big stories. I'd like you to address Italy's elections as well. Opposition leader Romano Prodi has been declared the official winner, defeating Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi in, one of Italy's closest races ever. According to the official count, Prodi's coalition won 158 Senate seats to Berlusconi's 156. Berlusconi lost even though he holds tremendous control over what Italians see and hear. Besides being Italy's sitting prime minister, the billionaire owns three of Italy's national TV stations, the largest publishing house, the largest advertising agency. He also owns the AC Milan soccer team and is considered to be Italy's wealthiest individual. Politically, he's been a close ally of President Bush and a supporter of the U.S.-led invasion and occupation of Iraq, now refusing to admit that he has lost the election to Romano Prodi.
We do not believe that today, as many things stand, someone can claim to have won, given the voting numbers which display many, many, many murky aspects. I would say too many.
Berlusconi is calling for a recount of thousands of disputed ballots. He lost by just 25,000 votes, making it the closest race in living memory. Meanwhile, Romano Prodi has announced plans to move ahead in forming a new government and has rejected Berlusconi's call to form a German-style grand coalition.
Alle elezioni con una coalizione precisa. La legge elettorale ha assegnato.
The elections have shown we have the needed number of parliamentarians for the upper and lower houses.
Noi governeremo in questo modo come stabilito dalla legge e come era l'impegno
This allows us to govern as directed by the law, and we will govern all of Italy.
That's Prodi. Gilbert Achecard, though you're a university professor at the University of Paris, you are in Italy right now. Can you talk about the significance of what's taking place there?
Well, first of all, Berlusconi has good reasons to reject the results and be such a bad loser, because he's afraid for his own self, as he faces the high possibility of being put on trial for various reasons, and he has already several trials. You know, he's been involved in so many financial scandals that, for him, one of the ways to avoid all that was to stay in power. But this being said, the situation here in Italy is quite, I would say the mood is quite bitter, because the left-wing opposition, or the center-left, as it is more accurately called, was expecting a much larger, much bigger victory than what they got. And a few weeks ago, the polls were giving them as winning by a much wider margin than the one they actually got. So, in a sense, nobody is happy here around, politically speaking. Berlusconi, because he's lost, technically speaking, and although the margin is very, very reduced, as you said, 25,000 votes is quite nothing. I mean, this is really a very, very thin margin. And on the other hand, the left cannot be enthusiastic with this kind of victory. And the question is already, why could Berlusconi win back make the margin narrower over the weeks? And one of the reasons that many people will give here is the fact that he has not been faced by a clear-cut rejection of the kind of neoliberal policies, and even the imperialist policies, in the sense that I'm referring to the Italy's participation in the occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan, but mainly Iraq. On both issues, Prodi as a leader of the center-left coalition, has not given very clear signals. There were quite ambiguous signals on these two issues, and that could be one of the reasons for this kind of narrow margin, because the differences were not so clear politically at the level of the programs. What remained was the difference between the persons, the personalities, and of course Berlusconi was denounced as a corrupt politician, and Prodi built on his image as a honest kind of politician. But
Gilbert Achecard, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you very much for joining us, University of Paris professor speaking to us from Italy. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, investigative reporter Greg Pallast.
Aéroport, réception d'une fille qui voulait changer de décor. Au départ, il fait la tête de mort, mais il est tout excité dès qu'il a aperçu son corps. Puis c'est lèche-vitrine, shopping à Belle Épine. Il a de l'eau sous les bras chaque fois qu'elle appelle le darling. Belle, elle est belle et bonne, et l'Italie l'appelle la belle. A bellissima belladonna, sa maman la no Madonna. Puis dans le living room, il veut faire boum boum. Sa copine arrive, ses yeux sont balles, doum doum. Il bébé gégayé, dit bébé, je sais pas qui c'est. Un menteur n'est jamais cru, même quand il dit la vérité. Qu'est-ce qu'elle a fait, dis-moi qu'est-ce qu'elle a fait. Qu'est-ce qu'elle a fait, dis-moi qu'est-ce qu'elle a fait. Quoi, tu sais pas?
Non, je sais pas.
Eh bien c'est simple, elle a chanté ça.
Lève les bras et danse avec moi.
En jean, en short ou en djellaba. Comme on le dit là-bas, bébé, Inch'Allah.
Lève les bras et danse avec moi.
En jean, en short ou en djellaba.
MC Timothy Salar here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Venezuela, the country is commemorating the fourth anniversary of a failed coup to overthrow democratically elected President Hugo Chavez. On April 11, 2002, Chavez was removed from power by a coalition of military officials and business leaders, but returned to office 2 days later. At a ceremony in Caracas on Tuesday, Venezuelan Vice President José Vicente Rangel unveiled a memorial to remember the victims of violence during the days of the coup. He reiterated accusations that the U.S. Embassy was deeply involved in the attempted overthrow. Rangel said the coup was, quote, carried out by the U.S. Embassy and by imperialism in Venezuela. Washington's denied any involvement. But over the years, millions of dollars in U.S. government money has been given to Venezuelan opposition groups under the auspices of the National Endowment for Democracy, a private agency funded entirely by the U.S. government. In a renewed sign of bad relations, Chavez is threatening to expel the U.S. ambassador, William Brownfield. Chavez accused him of meddling in Venezuela's internal affairs and of trying to provoke a protest Sunday when he traveled to a poor neighborhood with a large armed security detail. Chavez supporters pelted the ambassador's car with tomatoes and eggs during the visit. Meanwhile, Chavez is due to host an OPEC summit on June 1st in Caracas, Venezuela. Venezuela is the only Latin American member of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC. BBC investigative reporter Greg Pallas traveled to Venezuela recently, where he interviewed President Chavez. He files this report.
Buenos días a toda Venezuela.
This is the variety show host, revolutionary, and president of Venezuela, the inimitable Hugo Chavez, presenting his live 6-hour-long weekly television spectacular. Every Sunday, he flies his desk to a new location to perform for his thousands of screaming fans and voters. And now, this man, Chavez, is sitting on more oil than the king of Saudi Arabia. To George Bush, he's a demagogue awash in oil money. To this audience, he's a hero, savior.
Cuando yo quiera devolver, no serás tú quien lo decida.
And wannabe Frank Sinatra.
Welcome to the latest edition of South American Idol.
The streets of Caracas are filled with cruising Yank tanks. Why not? Petrol's cheaper than water, 3 pence a liter. You can fill up one of these beasts for about a pound.
Last time I was here in Venezuela, the president, Hugo Chavez, was in a bit of trouble. He'd just been kidnapped by the head of the Chamber of Commerce.
The attempted coup, which was welcomed by the Bush administration, failed. Chavistas brought their man back in triumph, but the oil stopped flowing, leaving Venezuela's economy in ruins and Chavez's long-term survival in doubt.
But then a cowboy rode out of the north and saved Hugo Chavez.
In 2003, George Bush invaded Iraq, and when mission accomplished became mission impossible, oil prices tripled.
The explosion in the price of oil dumped $50 billion into Hugo Chavez's lap, most of that from the United States. Let's go see what the money from the gringos in their SUVs bought.
In barrios like this, there's a happy bounce. Chavez has finally tackled the health and education problems suffered by Venezuela's poor. He's imported 15,000 Cuban doctors and teachers, too. Before Chavez spread the oil wealth, 55% of the population lived in poverty, and now poverty's down by a third, and 1.5 million people have been taught to read. In this building, we found a new Cuban clinic, and I ran into a resident who'd picked up English while working in Trinidad.
We are the only country on this planet that has so much or have so many changes in the social aspect. Medical attention free. We can never get free operations, x-rays, medicines, or education also. People who never knew how to write, read and write, now know how to sign their own papers and everything.
Arturo Caron invited me upstairs for a cold one.
Is this something new?
Chavez, he says, has changed the way oil money is handled.
10, 15 years ago, Carlos Andrés Pérez, there was a lot of oil money here in Venezuela. The oil boom, we call it. Okay, here in Venezuela, there was a lot of money entering the country, but we didn't see it.
Chavez has his opponents. Julio Borges is the leading opposition candidate in presidential elections to be held in December. He accepts that Chavez's populist policies have transformed Venezuela. Borges says his fellow oppositionists who won't take part in elections just don't get it.
Chavez has said the old parties are defunct, are corrupt, are no good. Do you agree or disagree with him?
Yeah, I think that the answer for Venezuela doesn't lie in the past. We are building a new generation, a new leadership, a renovation for the politics in Venezuela, and we believe that we have to move forward to the future. And we're not looking for the past.
Rather than attack Chavez's popular spending at home, Borges takes aim at Chavez's spending abroad.
The Chavez government has given out billions of dollars of your oil money to other Latin American governments to help them. Is that a good idea?
No. We have denounced it, that this money has been transformed and should be transformed in jobs, security, social security in Venezuela. We have a slogan, very clear, Primero Venezuela, first Venezuela. We have many necessities in Venezuela, and President Chavez is not the owner of oil. The oil is for Venezuela and the Venezuelans.
Hugo Chavez has called all the bankers of Latin America together, and when Chavez speaks, they listen.
The financiers were treated to a history of Venezuela's central bank in song, and the continent's central bankers were happy to hum along. Chavez has handed out billions to their treasuries. He's spending way more than George Bush in Latin America. And here's the man who actually writes the checks, Chavez's central banker, a very popular guy. In fact, Chavez wants to completely eliminate the International Monetary Fund and replace it with an International Humanitarian Fund. I caught up with Mr. Checkbook.
Can I get one more check, too? You're giving out checks to all these countries. Can I get a check?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. See you.
Okay. Ecuador got a quarter billion. Brazil got 4 billion. Argentina got 4 billion. No wonder these guys showed up.
Getting to see him wasn't a piece of cake. I drove around Caracas, waiting for a call from the palace. Then, weirdly, I found myself a surprise guest on his weekly variety show. Chavez got to make fun of my turista Spanish.
Hey, Greg, ¿cómo está tu español?
Español, es un atroz, pero just una pregunta.
I tried again at the presidential palace. I just had to ask Chavez what his oil was going to cost
us. The word to me.
Solo buscar un equilibrio.
We're trying to find an equilibrium. The price of oil could remain at the low level of $50. That's a fair price. It's not a high price.
Y ese es un precio, yo creo que justo, ¿sabe? No es un precio alto.
There's a good reason why Chavez is insisting on $50 a barrel. This is what the world's currently declared oil reserves look like, with most of the oil in the Middle East, especially Saudi Arabia. But at $50 a barrel, it becomes economic to exploit the world's vast undeclared reserves of heavy oil, and the picture changes radically.
According to an internal study we got our hands on from inside the U.S. Department of Energy, the next oil kingdoms, if the price of oil stays high, will be Canada, and Venezuela.
Atención presente.
Next month, Chavez hosts the meeting of OPEC, and will ask them to formally recognize that Venezuela now has more oil than the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
Tú sabes que Venezuela tiene la reserva de petróleo más grande del mundo.
Venezuela has the largest oil reserves in the world. In the future, Venezuela won't have any more oil. It is true. But that's in the 22nd century. Venezuela has oil for 200 years.
Chavez has won half a dozen elections since 1998, has no secret prisons, and hasn't invaded anyone. Nevertheless, Chavez finds himself the target of claims by Washington and Downing Street that he is a dictatorial international outlaw. It is true that recently his government brought criminal charges against political opponents for taking foreign donations. If the Chavistas' reaction to George Bush's involvement in their politics seems a bit paranoid, they actually have much to fear, according to these documents obtained by a U.S. investigator. Eva Gollinger uncovered the evidence that shows that the CIA knew about the 2002 coup in advance.
They had put up an article about my new radio program that I have here on a radio station, and people went on there and said, basically, you know, we're making all kinds of threats, and someone said, you should be gassed like the Jews were.
She complained to the federal prosecutor investigating the coup and the death threats. During the investigation, he was assassinated. The Chavistas are concerned about darker, more threatening scenarios, another coup, assassination, invasion. Their fears were intensified by comments from the likes of Pat Robertson, the influential U.S. evangelist.
We have the ability to take him out, and I think the time has come that we exercise that ability. We don't need another $200 billion war to get rid of one, you know, strong-arm dictator. It's a whole lot easier to have some of the covert operatives do the job and then get it over with.
Chavez says he's armed and ready for any threat. He showed me the sword of Simón Bolívar, the man who liberated South America from Spanish imperialism. He's even preparing for an American invasion. But does he really think this will happen?
I pray God this will not happen, because U.S. soldiers will bite the dust here, will die here, and we will die as well. Venezuelans will die as well. However, they will never succeed in dominating us. A 100-year war will start here if they ever dare. The U.S. people should know that if this happens, there will be no oil for anyone.
No habrá petróleo para nadie.
Parece a Dick Tracy. He's trying to steal my hat. Dick Tracy.
George Bush may dismiss him as a demagogue and show-off.
Agarré.
There you go.
Cuesta abajo en mi rodada.
I like it. Gracias.
But for Bush, the show may be over once Chavez is crowned king of oil.
Gracias, hermano. Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much.
Good luck.
Thank you.
That report filed by BBC investigative reporter Greg Palace, who joins us in the studio now. His upcoming book is called Armed Madhouse. It'll be published in June. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Glad to be here.
Greg, we only have a minute. You say that Venezuela has more oil reserves than Saudi Arabia?
Not only do I say it, obviously Hugo Chavez says it, and he's looking for official approval on June 1st from OPEC. But astonishingly, a internal U.S. Department of Energy report says that Chavez is modest, that he has something like five times the oil reserves of Saudi Arabia, because he has 90% of the world's extra heavy crude, which we know exactly where it is, and now it's going to be melted into petroleum and ultimately gas for your SUV. So Chavez is the new Abdullah of the Americas, and this is what's behind the whole U.S. policy of confrontation and provocation with Venezuela, is that we've had a foreign policy up to now, which is completely dominated by being close to the Saudis, and now we don't like the challenge of the Saudis, so we're taking on Chavez.
Well, we have to leave it there. Greg Palace, thanks for joining us. And for those who listened on radio, you can watch this report on our website, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Hedda Kaddous, John Hamilton, and Nagar Elizabeth Press, Yuba Rich, and Maddie Harper. Special thanks to Megan Peshkin and Megan Whitney. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.